Continuation of Business and Consumer Affairs Committee meeting of May 25th.
House Committee on Business and Consumer Affairs will reconvene. The clerk will note those members present, and I will open the hearing now on House Bill 2317. And I'm first going to call Nellie Fox.
So I can move this bill out? Oh, you want to have a hearing first? Which one, Bill?
2317. 2317. Lucky number. Place your bets. Hi, Nellie.
Thank you, Mr. Chairman, members of the committee. Nellie Fox, Legislative and Political Director, representing the AFL-CIO. And we're here today in support of House Bill 2317. The introduction of the Universal Pricing Code into the lives of the American consumer has led to a growing concern, a fear that the giant industry is about to impose a giant blindfold on grocery store shoppers. And while we talk about grocery stores, new plans are also being developed for the entire retail industry. A proposal called the National Retail Merchants Association Voluntary Retail Identification System projects a new technology which will be used for merchandise identification on all tickets, tags, and labels, with future plans to include credit cards and employee identification. The coding may be read by wands which equipment manufacturers are making to interface with the electronic scanner system. And I mention this to illustrate the dedication and the commitment of the industry to this type of merchandising. The efficiency of operations, development of new ideas and technology have their rightful place in today's economic market. And we want it fully understood that our position is not in opposition to the Universal Pricing Code and the scanner, but simply a requirement that readable prices be left on the merchandise. Frankly, I cannot understand why there is opposition to such a request. You wouldn't agree to purchase a car or a home without full disclosure of price. You don't wait until you're closing and then say, okay, by the way, give me a receipt so I can see if I've got enough money to pay for it. The logic escapes me. The pro-consumer arguments are many. Comparison shopping to see which product is the best buy, canned, frozen, or fresh. Comparing prices with previous purchases so a person knows the inflation ratio of a product. For fixed income families, that is many times a barometer as to being able to afford that item on their limited budget. As detailed as they claim the receipt to be, it's extremely limited. How do you check your slip against your memory of a shelf tag? And one of the attached exhibits gives you an illustration of just that type of a product problem. If you'll notice in your and it shows a receipt that has been manipulated, admittedly, but to give you an illustration of just exactly what the problems are. It says, let me make it clear that this tape does not represent someone doing his or her regular food shopping. This is a structured tape, deliberately structured to make a point. Notice that the first five items are all coffee mate and all at different prices. There are five different prices because there's five different sizes of coffee mate. If the prices are removed from the package and all you have to rely on is the tape, how can you compare one coffee mate purchase with a previous one if you don't know the size? And you can see the duplication in both tapes. Notice down at the bottom, the company managed to squeeze in size. Great. But very, very mystifying. Here are the eight different bottles of olives that we purchased. If you study that list carefully, you simply must ask yourself the question, why are 7 ounces of olives priced at both 99 cents and 85 cents? And why are 2 ounces of olives priced at 49 cents and 39 cents? Look at the labels of the 2 7-ounce bottles. There's a difference in colors of the labels. Same thing goes for the 2 ounce jars. We studied this problem for a considerable period until it slowly dawned on us that you paid 14 cents more for 1 7-ounce jar and 10 cents more for the 2 ounce jar because they were hand-packed. But there's nothing on the label to tell you that. Nothing. The chances of a programming error either by accident or by intent, can cost consumers thousands of dollars. The claim of quicker checkout service to the customer could soon be negated by fewer check stands and longer waiting lines. The system is extremely expensive to install, and few companies could operate as many checkout stands as they have today. The companies claim that a great savings could be generated for the consumer should be taken with a grain of salt, I feel. Having worked in the retail industry myself, I've seen precious few savings passed on to the consumer. The merchandising techniques are strictly geared to separate the customer from his money, with little concern as to the ethics of what they are doing. A survey and analysis of cost of keeping prices on items in a grocery store was made by Garvey Levelmatic and is attached as an exhibit to my testimony, and it speaks for itself. And I do hope, I won't go into it and take your time up in committee to run through it, but I do hope that you will read that and study what they have done, and they show you just exactly how little it really costs to keep the prices on. Their report shows a total of $47.34 a week is all that the cost is involved in keeping prices on packages in a very substantially large food store, and we think that's well worth it. One last problem that has received little or no attention is the problem that the universal pricing code causes to a small manufacturer. Food retailing depends heavily on the manufacturer's marketing techniques, and since new computer provided information could lead to more profitable shelf location in food stores, it could also lead to a vicious struggle over who gets a shelf space. Since a smaller manufacturer has only limited marketing ability, he might have a harder time, since the retailer can now point to a printout and show that an item is not moving in a comparable fashion to another, which is backed up by more substantial advertising and marketing programs. In addition, what effect will the additional production cost required by the application of the universal pricing code have on a small manufacturer? Obviously, larger and more profitable manufacturers can adjust more easily to printing the symbols on their product. To one manufacturer with a limited distribution to 30 different products, the new cost of $30,000 might be prohibitive. To another, such as General Mills, that amount could be covered out of petty cash. But since we have a free marketplace, wouldn't the small manufacturer have the option of simply choosing not to affix the UPC to his product? Sure, he could, at least according to Stephen Brown, the attorney for the Ad Hoc Grocery Committee, which invented the UPC. Brown says this: what has been done by this group is to simply make a recommendation to the grocery industry, which is up to each individual within the industry to implement it as it chooses. But if you believe that quote, you are totally unfamiliar with the facts of life in the supermarket today. Try another quote that deals with the situation realistically. It may soon be difficult for those items not bearing a UPC symbol to find a place in the retail stock pattern. Those are the words of Roger Serwick, retail systems analyst for Super Value Stores. Sure, the small manufacturer may not elect to affix the UPC symbol simply because he can't afford it, but he may also put himself out of business if he cannot find a place for his stock. This prospect would not be so frightening were it not for the fact that in 1966, there were 32,500 food manufacturing firms in the United States. The largest 100 firms took 71% of the profit. By 1972, the total numbers of the firms declined to 26,800. Almost 6,000 firms went out of business and were not replaced over a period of 6 years. UPC will add fuel to the fire of diminishing competition caused by more manufacturers going out of business. The American consumer will pay the cost of diminished competition. Mr. Chairman, members of the committee, House Bill 2317 is a simple bill, but is dealing with a basic right that people are demanding more and more, that right for an individual to be fully informed, to know about the things that affect their lives and a growing rebellion against the domination of big business, even on such a small issue as prices on the packages. I certainly urge your support for the bill.
Thank you, Millie. That's this. Oh, it's a picture of me and the governor. All right. Senator Groner standing beside me. Questions for Ms. Fox? Representative Morris.
We had a very preliminary, inconclusive report on the reaction of the consumer, and I showed you a copy of it earlier. And I really, you can't draw any conclusion from it because it is totally inconclusive, but just with that little smattering, that smidgen that you saw, do you have any response? Is there really, in fact, from the consumer, is this a real need at this moment in time?
I think it is, Representative Morris. This is a new idea. It is growing fast in Oregon. There are now 3 stores that have it, and before the end of the year, or at least by the end of next year, there will be roughly somewhere in the neighborhood of 12 stores that will have it, and so it's coming into the area fast. People are not yet totally aware of what it will be doing to them. They haven't realized the full impact of what this mechanism will do to their shopping habits, especially because the prices are still on them now.
Because of the lateness of the session and the practicality that at best this would be difficult to get through, and I think we have to be realistic, and the lack of really hard evidence of whether the public does or does not support it, is it a reasonable approach to try and get the hard data, the market survey, and make a concerted effort if in fact the consumer, this is a consumer need to be met, to make a run with it next session? We're talking now May, this isn't February, so mm-hmm. I think we have to be realistic.
Well, the logistics of time are very apparent. I would feel negligent in my duty, though, if I didn't try to.
I understand that. I understand.
I think the public response in other places where they have had the scanner in operation has been very indicative that they want the prices left on it. And in somewhere in my materials, I have documentation of that.
If it were the legislative decision that we simply were unable to secure passage of the bill for this session, would you support any effort or assist any legislative committee during the interim to try and secure an update of the data for here in Oregon so that we could get the substantiation for the need?
I'd be glad to.
Further questions, Representative Bryant?
A couple of comments on Representative Morris's. One of the things I noticed from looking at the report we got from the Thriftway was, one, that 6 of the 14 items didn't delineate what they were, 6 out of 14. And one thing you have to understand is that store has the prices on the items now, so it's hard to ask them a question of, you know, would you shop here, or how do you feel about taking the prices off? Because they were shopping in a new system that most people have. I was surprised that the odds were that bad, that a third of the people didn't like it. Most of the people in Bend will like the system after they get used to it. It seals a lot faster. But they have the prices on the cans, too. And the manager of Wagner's has reportedly said that, you know, the consumers will not let him take it off. And if I had faith that, you know, they would stick with that, we wouldn't need this legislation. But the national government is moving in this direction. I passed out literature the other day to that effect. Mm-hmm. And the way I see the store taking off, forgetting to price a few items every week, you know. So you slowly transform the store over to no prices. You wouldn't do it to just cut it off. You know, you wouldn't just stop marking everything in the store, I don't believe. You might start 1 week with one item, and a few weeks later phase into something else. When you buy brush.
I viewed the scanner when they had it set up in the room upstairs, and in discussing the process and with the people who are operating it, we asked them what happened when there was a breakdown in any part of the system, because there seemed to be several different units that were related to each other in the process, and their reaction to that was that, well, the cash register could operate as an independent unit on itself, and they could continually to operate manually just as they do now. And of course, to operate in that manner with the other, the scanner part of it out of operation, they would have to have the prices on there anyway. So it looks to me like it's just a safeguard, a backup anyway, for the mechanical breakdowns that are bound to happen in most any piece of machinery from time to time.
Yeah, it probably have to happen once or twice without prices on merchandise. And
you really create a havoc.
Be something on it.
Mm-hmm.
Hmm. Oh, one crucial point. Seems that, and I'm sure this committee could do the same, but it seems to me that when unit pricing got to the Senate, it took 6 days from the time of the first hearing, and slightly less than 6 days till it got to the floor. So, but who knows if the House passed this bill, the same thing might happen.
It was introduced on the day of Tiny Die and adopted by both houses.
Right.
Mm-hmm.
Right.
I've seen bills introduced the first day of the session languish forever.
Yeah.
In one place.
Right.
Matter of fact, they even disappeared. I've seen bills completely disappear and evaporate.
Did you check drawers?
I wasn't in the position to try and check some of those drawers. Questions? Comments? Thank you, Nellie.
Thank you.
Oh, okay. Good. I'll mention that in a minute, along with two other things, okay? Let's see. Who else is here? Is it Lon? Is it Imel?
Imel.
Imel, okay, Lon. Sorry.
No.
Good evening. Or afternoon. I guess it's still afternoon. It's just dark out.
Right. I won't, Mr. Chairman and committee, it won't take too much of your time. I am Lon Imel from Local 1092. Which we represent the largest division of organized employees in the retail field in the Oregon area. And I wish to support what Nellie had said, and I hope that you do find time to read her report in detail. Mm-hmm. And we do support this legislation, and it's valuable to the consumer. And sometimes I think the best way to ask if this is a valuable bill is really, if you're married, ask your wife, and if you're not, your girlfriend, or whoever it may be that does the shopping for you. And if you go into a store and you buy items and they're not marked, you're very concerned. And a lot of the stores now, and mentioned to what the person who stated over there, saying that it was important to have it marked on there. And we've had cases where you will go into a unit and there may be a sale the previous week. And one of the biggest complaints our members get from the customer is the fact that some items are not marked. And so it's very valuable that they are marked for that consumer. And I think it is a consumer-type legislation. It's important for the little lady who comes in that's on Social Security to be able to know what she's paying for those items. And some of the stores in the larger Portland area who are moving towards the scanning system have now deleted the shelf price on the shelves, and the only price that appears is on that particular item. And so we feel it's very valuable that this stays as a consumer item, and that the legislation does pass this bill. And so I'm open for any questions.
Fine, thank you, Lon. Questions, members of the committee? Representative Shaw.
Mr. Chairman, isn't this a bill to offset the scanning device?
No, the scanning device actually does quicken the process, depending on how the package is. If there's some damage to that scanning.
No,
excuse me, I misunderstood.
Yeah, let me rephrase it. It's to make sure that those stores that have scanning devices that wouldn't necessarily need the pricing on each item, make sure that they do, because then they wouldn't have to have it. So,
well,
isn't this directed at those places that would have scanning devices?
Yes, because the stores that presently don't have scanning machines, naturally they'd have to have the price there to reflect as the clerk checks the product out.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
This covers all stores. Scanning devices, we said 1.5 million in gross, and here we're encompassing everybody.
Right.
Even warehouse markets.
No, I think that you'll find in the bill that there is a deletion on those warehouse markets that use the grease marking system, and that's a little trend-type pencil, that those stores will operate as they have in the past, and the customer there, you know, they're used to that system, and that's part of the sales of that type of warehouse marketing. So the customer goes through, if you've never been in one, it's a very close to a warehouse situation where the items are stacked, and then the customer marks them from the shelf, and then they go through the check stand system. A scanning system at that type of unit would not work.
Mr. Chairman?
Yes, go ahead.
I guess what I'm getting at is that this thing should be directed at strictly those stores that use scanning devices.
Yes, I would probably agree with you on that point.
Further questions? Thank you very much, sir.
Thank you.
Albert Green? Is Mr. Green here? I realize that people signed up early in the day expecting this to occur somewhat near afternoon. I guess Mr. Green isn't here. For the record, I'd also like the committee members to take note of there's testimony that was submitted by Mr. Otto Wilson, Associated Oregon Industries, and whatever subsidiary branch that they represent for the retail division or whatever, and also Mr. Manley Backison from United Grocers, and their testimony in opposition to the bill. Also, I'd like to announce that Madeline Serflin stayed over this evening to be able to share with you, if you would like to have her share with you, the questionnaire or survey. Actually, questions, if you have any questions on her survey.
I would like to ask one.
Okay, fine. Madeline, you identify yourself for the record, employee of the committee, I guess.
Okay. I'm Madeline Serflin, employed by the Business and Consumer Affairs Committee.
I would like to ask the question, what kind of a response did you feel or do you have with this survey? I noticed that you were raising your hand, thank you, a moment ago.
Well, that was in response to Representative Vian's question about why there wasn't an explanation of certain items. If a consumer pulls a can of 7-Up out of a 6-pack, it now doesn't have a price marked on it. It's packaged with that scanning code. So they hand punch that, and they hand punch vegetables and whatever they sell by the pound. And they told me that the consumer is going to have to be the person that oversees the checker to make sure that they punch in the right amount on those kinds of items. Also on produce, you'll notice that it's listed how many pounds, how much it was per pound, etc. So they do a lot of hand punching.
It appears that this process, this equipment, accelerates checkout considerably.
That's what most people thought.
And that the consumer likes it.
Those 14 people said that they liked it.
How long did it take to acquire these 21 comments.
Oh, about 45 minutes. But then I didn't try to talk to everybody because they it would have backed up traffic right there at the check stand. The answer to your first question.
Can you speak up, please? I can't.
Okay. In answer to the first question, I was a little surprised that there were 14 people that didn't care and said that they didn't really mind whatever the groceries did was all right because they never checked their slip after they got home. They didn't take the time to do it anyway. They weren't going to be bothered with comparison buying. I want you to know that I went there at night, and that might have not been a good time to get housewives that buy in quantity.
What time, Madeline, was it? That
what was 8, between 8 and maybe 8:30 to 9:30.
Maybe
so
more impulse buyers than maybe the
right.
comparative shoppers during
right.
the day.
And like you mentioned, it really isn't a good statistical kind of survey. But those people were nearly exuberant about it. They, yeah, I really like to watch it go. It's kind of, I was surprised by that reaction.
Would you personally like to shop by this method?
Scanning?
I don't know. I don't think so, but then I haven't had the experience with the machine. You do have to watch because it does go faster and the numbers come up faster.
Do you check your slip when you get home? Compare it with the...
Oh, yes. Always. Yeah.
A lot of questions unanswered, yes.
Yeah. I didn't see the demonstration or anything, but just how quick can they go across that scanner?
The basket is pulled into about the same position that it would with an ordinary checking system, and if you have 3 cans of the same kind of item, they take one can and kind of wave it over. There's a little window on that end. They wave it over there 3 times and then reach in and grab the other 2 and set them all down. And so they are not, you know, moving each and every item across if they're like items. I don't know because, you know, I have no way of measuring time for you.
Was it so fast that you couldn't comprehend it, or was it fast enough, slow enough to where you could understand and see what was going on?
I could see it because I was, you know, I was concentrating on that. But some people, while they're getting their checkbooks out and, or, you know, with a child talking to somebody that's with them, you could very easily not, you know, you could miss things. But one of the ladies said that she always, if she found a mistake in her thing, she was a comparison shopper, one of the other 7, she said she had found mistakes and she went back and she'd found them on that by using that tape and comparing with what she'd gotten home with.
Hmm.
But
then you'd have to have both. You'd have to have both, wouldn't you?
Yeah.
Otherwise, there wouldn't be any key.
Mm-hmm.
You got home, you wouldn't know.
Right.
Further questions? Thank you, Mammy. Oh, did you have a question, Representative Karen? Did I see your hand up? I'm sorry, I thought I saw your hand up.
Is there anyone else wishing to appear on House Bill 2317? Once and for all, on the hearing.
Do we have amendments prepared?
If not, that concludes the hearing. We finally made it by only 5:30 this evening.
5:35.
We finally made it through the hearings, and we're ready for the work session. I don't know, members of the committee, there's talk about next week of switching the days to Monday, Thursday session as opposed to a Thursday, Friday. That being the case,
which days?
Monday, Thursday as opposed to Thursday, Friday. So instead of having the Monday, Wednesday block for committee hearings, breaking it up. And I'm not sure what wisdom is behind that, and I haven't argued one way or the other between the Speaker and the Rules Committee as to why, and the Senate, why that ought to be. But if that does occur, it seems to me that we're probably going to have to plan a work session Monday night. And I just thought I'd announce that now.
Can I ask a question?
Basketball game.
I don't know. Tuesday night's the basketball.
Sunday.
Tuesday night's the basketball.
That's right.
Yeah, Tuesday night. Now, I definitely can't have a work session Tuesday night. No.
Okay.
That's out. That's out.
But yeah, can we put...
Why don't we bring a team here and we could hold session during the quarter break?
Wow.
Environment Energy went through a whole hearing with the TV on.
The problem with that is the chairman of the committee thinks he's going to be a lot closer to that game than in Washington television.
Question? What's your target date for shutting this dude down?
This committee... Even though it's been announced that it may be shutting down or looking to shut down around June 3rd, this committee in all likelihood will probably be continuing clear up to sine die.
Does that include state government operations?
State government operations is getting quite a workload, and so the Rules Committee has reviewed the makeup of this committee, assuming that it's a very balanced and reasonable committee and talented and expeditious. And they thought that perhaps this committee could stay open also and be a repository as some of the other committees shut down and the bills
so
will be shifted here.
So both those committees will probably go to plenty down.
Yeah. Well, revenue will go, revenue, ways and means, state government operation, judiciary, and this committee.
I got both of those.
Yeah. And I'm on two, too.
Four people.
Yeah. Whoopee, it means... our workload will never slack off. So we just collapse in a heap. Right.
Let's see if we can go through the easy ones first and work up to the hard ones. How about Senate Bill 714? Is that the hard one?
That's the easy one first?
Oh, I thought it was easy. I thought it was resolved.
Sure.
Isn't it resolved?
Sure.
Okay. Senate Bill 714.
It's going to be shortly.
I want resolve.
All right. This is the bill to clarify the definition of sex discrimination as it relates to pregnancy. And, let's see.
Where's Representative Bryan? Good. Kind of liking around. Close.
Didn't you have a game?
Okay. Huh? Mm-hmm. Did we have this too?
Did he have to leave? Did he have to leave at 6:30? 5:30?
Yeah.
He did? All right. Well, we'll see what we can do.
Okay. You should have a proposed amendment to Senate Bill 714.
Mm-hmm.
Oh, yeah.
Okay, let's,
sure.
Okay.
Yeah.
Mm-hmm. Okay, this is the, to start over, this clarifies the prohibition against sex discrimination for the cases of pregnancy. There was some uncertainty as to the proposed language on lines 9 through 13 in terms of just how that might be applied in specific cases. So the proposed amendment takes the language from the Equal Employment Opportunities Commission.
Go ahead.
Guidelines that have been in effect
since March of 1972 and are currently used by Oregon and 25 other states in interpreting Title VII. As you know from the other discrimination bills, the Bureau of Labor utilizes the federal case law in determining just what constitutes discrimination. So this language relating it to a temporary disability is the current guideline that has been in effect since 72 and is what is being used at the Bureau. The proposal is to enact this, to clarify, well, to give more visibility to the legislative direction that, yes, discrimination based on sex includes disabilities caused by pregnancy in these circumstances. Now, the essence of what this language is pretty clear if you just read through it, but it says not pregnancy itself, but a disability caused by pregnancy, which for normal, healthy births would be just a matter of a couple weeks or whatever, that condition is a temporary disability and for all employment-related purposes would be treated the same as any other temporary disability. Okay. Now, the way that...
Can you repeat, Diane? Just, I think your last couple of sentences are crucial.
Okay. Well, I'll just kind of read from this. Disabilities caused or contributed to by pregnancy shall be considered temporary disabilities and for any employment-related purpose are going to be treated the same as any other temporary disability. And the language, well, I'll just read the last sentence. Employment policies and practices involving matters such as the commencement and duration of leave, the availability of extensions, the accrual of seniority and other benefits and privileges, reinstatement, and payment under any health or temporary disability insurance or sick leave plan shall be applied to a disability due to pregnancy or childbirth on the same terms and conditions as they are applied to other temporary disabilities. So the effect is whatever kind of program you have for your employees relating to temporary disabilities, that pregnancy would be included under the same terms and conditions as others.
Well, pregnancy or disability
is due to pregnancy.
Disability
is due to pregnancy. Disability is due to pregnancy.
Yeah. Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Shaw.
Just one more. Clarify it again. If I understand it correctly now, we're not talking about them receiving benefits or such from pregnancy, but strictly, due to pregnancy, but strictly disabilities caused by pregnancy.
Yeah.
Okay. Complications of pregnancy.
Okay.
Mm-hmm. Yeah.
You know, the actual period of childbirth and recovery would probably be considered a disability, but the 9 months previous to that under normal pregnancies would not, unless there were complications there earlier.
Put me right back in.
Excuse me, I had to talk to my roommate just a minute.
Okay.
Dan, could you describe some of the circumstances around childbirth that would relate to disability? I'm trying to get parameters.
The actual birth itself, the taking the mm-hmm. 3 days off in the hospital, that is a temporary disability that's pregnancy related, as would a miscarriage or I don't know, whatever other complications might arise previous to the delivery or subsequent to. But it would have to be a disability that was caused. Would have to be a disability caused by the pregnancy, not the pregnancy itself.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Klein.
A sponsor of the legislation approached me yesterday
with some concern about what might happen with the bill, and I was wondering if she had been approached with the amendments and if she had offered an opinion of them.
You talking about Senator Roberts? Yes, she is. She's aware of the amendment.
And what's her opinion of it?
Favorably or unfavorably?
She's favorably, yes. Disposed.
Do you have her voting?
No, I don't. Her preference, you know, I can't speak for her. I don't think Richard is here. He was. Her preference is to keep the existing language. The existing language is taken from the federal bill, which has passed the House, is going to work session in Senate subcommittee tomorrow. So it's very likely that Congress is going to enact the original language here. And that's why 714 was put in, so that it would be in exact compliance. However, the proposed amendment language is like the administrative rule that was adopted from the above language, and so they would be consistent.
If the full committee was present, I'd probably make a motion to
make a motion on
the
original. Mr. Chairman, before we do that, I see some serious head shaking out there among the. Was there are there additional amendments to this bill that have been proposed by the industry, just for purposes of discussion?
Yes. There's a suggestion that since the question of to what extent does pregnancy benefits need to be provided in health insurance is not delineated specifically here. And I'm advised there is no case law on that.
I'm sorry, say again.
The question of whether health insurance for hospital medical benefits as opposed to disability insurance would under this language be required to offer, employers to be required to offer pregnancy coverage. Not all parties are comfortable that this is clear enough on that subject. The proposed amendment is to add a section 3 to, I'll just read it, it says the insurance commissioner shall by rule establish requirements for compliance with section 2 of this act by policies and certificates of group insurance delivered or issued in this state. So,
the question from their part is, what if you don't have any of these policies?
No.
You still would require them?
No, that's not a question. It's clear that if you don't cover any temporary disabilities, you don't have to cover pregnancy.
Okay.
The question is, strictly for the health insurance policy, if you cover, say, some temporary disabilities, it's a gray area in terms of could you be subject to sex discrimination suit if you covered some but not all temporary disabilities and pregnancy was one that you excluded?
Complications of pregnancy was one that you excluded.
Right.
You need to be more definitive then.
There's a difference of opinion on the need to be definitive.
You think it's clear enough, obviously.
Well, I think in all fairness to the administrative assistant, she thinks, in consulting with some of the parties, that they think that it is definitive. However, there are parts of the lobby representing some of the hospital groups and or representing some of the medical interests who do not think it is definitive enough. So the policy decision we're going to have to decide upon is whether or not we think it is. And that is the question.
Is there any proposed amendments from those people that would make it, quote, more?
That is the proposed amendment you just had read to you.
Yeah.
So you now have, you have this amendment, which was an attempt at a compromise, which is agreeable, incidentally, by the sponsor of the bill, and is also agreeable by the advocates for the bill. It's also incidentally agreeable by Mr. Lansing, representing, does he represent Blue Cross? Is that who he represents? Yeah. All right. Representing Blue Cross, or at least the last conversation I had with him, that was true. Now, whether or not that's changed, I have no idea.
Mr. Chairman.
Yes, Representative Klein.
For the purposes of discussing something that's on the table, I'd move the original proposed amendment. Dated May
25th. I think we ought to have something. If you want to move the other, we can.
Okay.
All right, I accept that motion. The motion to amend the bill, which is to add the new language that you see as proposed amendment dated May 25, 1977. Is there discussion on that? Clerk, let's call the roll.
Representative Vitulli?
Do you have one?
No.
Representative Achilles?
Oh, he's got to read. He didn't have a topic.
30 seconds.
One ticket. It's all right.
Aye.
Stavish?
You reach past the line. Aye.
Cairns?
Aye.
Klein?
Aye.
Morris?
Aye.
Shaw?
Aye.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye. Motion passes. Mr. Crawford. I will allow you
30 seconds.
To explain in 30 seconds
okay.
your position.
I want to say that Mr. Crawford has been real busy this week trying to work out something with... so that everybody knew what we were talking about on the bill.
Thank you, Deanne. Mr. Chairman, I'm Hank Crawford, representing OPS. I'm also authorized to tell you that you are 99% right. Both OPS and Blue Cross think this is a good amendment that you've just voted on. However, both of us also feel that for the protection of problems, and there are already problems with this, by the way, on a national level, there are some court suits as to what does it really mean. Does it really mean that we cover pregnancy from day one if it wasn't a pre-existing disease because we cover something else? Now, we think we all understand what we're talking about on that. But by putting this amendment that we have in, that it will allow the insurance commissioner to clarify these situations, we feel much better protected as to what we're all communicating about. And it's obvious to all of us it's a very, very complicated subject. And the part of the new amendments that you've just adopted that create the problem of having to have somebody define for us what's going on is the fact that you're not using the words only disability insurance, you're using medical and disability insurance or health and disability, whichever it is as it's related there. And with the appearance of that health, then you're talking about the standard everyday type of OPS, Blue Cross, Aetna health policies, hospitalization. Hopefully we'll need somebody, hopefully we won't need somebody, but it would be great if there was somebody that could define and say when the question comes up, yes, you have to cover this much because also in your policies you're offering this much. That's all we're asking for.
Question? Your question of Mr. Crawford?
Yeah, if you don't mind, Mr. Chairman, just one or two. That didn't help me a whole lot.
Sorry about that.
No, it's not your fault. It is a very complicated subject, and this language, which is apparently picked up out of federal regulations, doesn't help me a whole lot either. If you have complications of pregnancy, then your health package shall give you coverage for it if you cover any other disability under that health package.
Right.
Is
now
that correct?
Here's where we have the problem.
Is that what
we're
saying?
No.
That's what we want to say.
Yes. That, by the way, occurs right now, so it doesn't make any difference to us whether it's in here or not. Complications of pregnancies are covered even in health policies, majority of them anyway,
right.
That don't cover pregnancy. They'll
right.
still take care of the complications.
Right.
I think when Deanne and I and Mr. Bunnell from OPS were conversing over this, she can probably straighten out better than I can, because this lady is an expert in this field. I've discovered that real quickly. Is that we use the example that if we cover the disability of appendicitis in our health policy, we have to cover the disability of pregnancy. And that doesn't mean complications from. It's disabling if you have to go to the hospital with it. Just as the appendectomy is disabling if you're in the hospital with it. So the part of the amendment that triggers the health insurance to the pregnancy itself, to that pregnancy coverage, pregnancy benefits, is by having it say here under any health or temporary disability insurance. If you did not have health insurance included in that amendment, what would happen is that the disability policy of the company would pick up whatever, however it was written, the disability, just like it would for any other operation or any other disability. But as long as you have health in there, you're comparing then the pregnancy term itself, the doctor calls, the whatever it is, are comparable to these other things. The question is, just exactly as Deanne said, the weighing of them. If you offer these and you offer these, then does that balance and you don't have to offer the pregnancy? Well, it becomes so complicated that there are only two solutions, it seems. One of them is to wipe health out of there, which you're not inclined to want to do, I can tell, and I don't blame you. We'd love it, by the way, but I don't blame you for not wanting to. The other one is to allow the insurance commission to be able to look at this and determine what it is that is fair in meeting exactly the criteria that you've set up here and the intent that you've voiced here.
I'm not sure what our intent is in doing this, Mr. Crawford. It seems to me our intent is to deal as this amendment, as we've just adopted it, seems to say that disabilities caused or contributed by pregnancy, childbirth, and related medical conditions, not the term of pregnancy itself, but those things that might be come as disabilities as a result of that condition.
Okay, that's why I think our amendment becomes important, you see, because I realize that's your intent. If the insurance commissioner realizes that is your intent and you've given him rulemaking authority, I would assume that tent has a much better chance of being carried out.
Are you afraid that you come to the end of your coming in 9 months and all of a sudden you're disabled because in fact you went to the hospital the night before to have a baby and you're now disabled and your health care plan is now going to pay for that because you're disabled? Is that what you're saying?
No, I think that this makes it clear that it would pay for that. What we're worried about is the previous 9 months before the delivery.
Yeah, I don't think they have any problem with the birth itself.
No.
Or complications. They have a problem with the healthy condition of pregnancy and having to pay for the doctor visits once a week or whatever.
It's a very good phrase you've just used. That's exactly what we're talking about here. Talking about in some of these policies which do not have the benefit of pregnancy in them are policies derived to take care of ill people. And Deanne just said it. What we're concerned about is the healthy condition of pregnancy. We'll take care of the sick conditions automatically that arrive from it, the complications, the things that you've just talked about. And as I'm understanding this coming together here, is that's what you believe you want done too. What I'm saying to you, that court cases looking at this language may have a big problem. If your intent is there are rules promulgated by the insurance commissioner to carry out your intent, then we probably do not have a big problem.
What is his amendment again? Could we read that?
Representative Klein, well, first, Representative Klein has a question, then we'll... Mr. Chairman, I'm sorry.
Pardon?
I tried to be brief, I'm sorry.
That's all right.
I assume someone from the insurance commissioner's office
right.
as well in the audience. And the question, I guess, could be directed to either one or both of you. And it has
Mr.
to do...
Why don't you come right on up to Mike's and
because you're probably going to get to say something.
What we're going to do with this question is to carry on a short discussion. I hope what the state of the art is in the industry. And is my impression correct if I was to say that a health policy which did not make a specific exemption for pregnancy was owned by an individual who was pregnant and there was a complication as a result of that pregnancy, that complication would then currently be treated due to the fact that the complication itself is not the pregnancy. In other words, let's say that any kind of problem after childbirth, for example.
Well, normally a health policy will specifically talk about pregnancy somewhere in the policy, I believe, in the definition of illness or whatever. If it wants to exclude pregnancy, it would do so by specific language. If there is no exclusion for pregnancy, then I would assume it has to cover pregnancy and complications of pregnancy.
I would have to agree with that with my limited knowledge. Certainly he's much more knowledgeable than I. I should mention to you also that the amendments that you have there that include the insurance commission were shown to the commissioner yesterday, and he agreed that it would be a function he would be willing to take on if that was your pleasure. That would not come as a shock to him, but those amendments.
It came as a shock to me. I hadn't seen them, and I just had a very big concern that if the committee can't decide what the intent of this bill is, I don't know how a commissioner's rule can help to straighten that out. It's hard enough to adopt rules when you've got clear legislative intent.
Isn't the intent just to take care of the unhealthy aspects of pregnancy and to exclude the healthy aspects of pregnancy?
Well, it was not clear to me from this dialogue at all, but I wondered, is this bill directed toward the medical and hospital costs of pregnancy, of the normal delivery, as well as the time off work?
Yes.
So these various bills that deal with the question of mandating pregnancy coverage are rendered unnecessary by this bill. This bill mandates hospital coverage for pregnancy if the employer has a health plan covering other illnesses.
Other disabilities.
Disability.
Yeah.
Disability.
Well, that's a disability and hospital medical are two different types of health insurance coverage.
Right.
And I clearly got that this bill is talking about time off work, which is a so-called disability plan, paying you your salary for even though you're off work because you're disabled.
I can't do that.
But I wasn't clear from the discussion whether it also covered hospital medical expenses for the delivery of the child.
Okay, I think the answer to that is this language has been in effect for 5 years, and there has never been a case where someone alleged discrimination because they weren't getting pregnancy coverage until fairly recently.
The General Electric case.
No, that was disability. That wasn't health.
There has been
no final resolution of the question based on this language. And we are advised by the Bureau that they have not had any complaints and they are not aware of any case law. So I guess my recommendation is, since this has been the guideline for 5 years, and is the guideline in 26 states, and this language is currently under litigation, that the
it's beyond us tonight to try to solve that problem, and that it will be solved.
Mr. Chairman.
But meanwhile, what you said is right in the other language talking about sick leave, reinstatement, various other things, which is the primary intent of the bill, is delineated in there.
I'm still confused if we're talking about extraordinary, the disabilities of pregnancy or normal health care.
Would you like to ask the question out loud for the record, Representative Morse, or would you like to just hold private counsel with the administrative assistant?
I would like to know, in my own mind, really where the thrust of we're trying to go with this bill. Are we trying to cover, quote, all pregnancies, or are we trying to cover those pregnancies that are outside of the normal healthy pregnancy?
We are trying to cover complications, unusual complications prior to delivery, and the disability caused by the delivery itself.
Mr. Chair.
All right.
Mr. Chair.
Okay. Okay. Representative Klein.
I think the last sentence of the amended bill pretty well is pretty clear in terms of what we're doing. It just says that we're applying benefits to this on the same basis and terms as to other temporary disabilities.
Okay.
And so I'm going to move the bill to force to do pass recommendation as amended.
Mr. Chairman.
Discussion. Representative Cairns.
So that I understand that what Deanna just said, the bill would mandate a health policy cover labor and delivery costs to the same amount or in the same terms as they would cover the hospital and medical expenses incurred by another temporary disability under that health care plan. And that if that policy excludes all temporary disabilities, they're not discriminating. But if they let in one disability and not pregnancy, then they are discriminating. Is that the case?
Up until your last phrase.
Oh, okay.
If they let in one and exclude a bunch,
including
pregnancy, then it would have to be decided by the Civil Rights Division or the court whether that exclusion was due to pregnancy discrimination, sex discrimination, or whether it was a
economic or some other ground.
Right.
But if there were 7 or 8, but not the pregnancy, then there would be some prima facie evidence or some conclusive presumption of discrimination that one could act on and go to the Labor Commission with. That right? That's the intent of what we're doing, isn't it?
If the effect of the coverage was discriminatory, then there would be, it could be valid if the employer could show that the distinction was based on something other than sex or pregnancy or, well, but, you know, the whole list, race, sex, marital status, whatever. Mm-hmm. If the exclusion of pregnancy benefits was based on something else, I'm not a lawyer. I was going to say probably in your situation where everybody in the company was past childbearing age, maybe that wouldn't be. But I don't know. I don't know how they're going to come down.
All right. Further questions?
No, I.
Further discussion.
I got it, man.
Yes.
Okay. Yes.
Any input from AOI or others representing employers to determine what I would gather the potential cost of this, as amended, is significantly less than the potential original cost that was ill-defined. Have you had any conversations with the employer side? Does this satisfy some of their early concerns?
I have had. As you can probably tell, this language just came about late today. I have not run it by AOI. But as I said, it is the rule that has been in effect in Oregon for 5 years. So I wouldn't think there'd be any very big problem with it. It was because of this rule that Tektronix adopted their program.
But there has been no rule in Oregon that a health insurance program had to cover pregnancies.
Right.
And that
this language is strictly a guideline on to help determine what is or is not sex discrimination. And the health insurance part of it is
I think Mr. Howard, that distinction has been made adequately in the committee.
Mm-hmm. Mr. Chairman?
Yes.
Question of Mr. Crawford.
Yes, Representative.
You've been grinning and chuckling. Does my interpretation meet with your with what you see that bill is doing?
Yes.
Yes, okay. Yes.
My grinning and chuckling has been because I don't think anybody was seeing it until you finally got it out where it was.
Now, the second question is, for all practical purposes, what's the impact? I mean...
Financial impact?
Yeah, what's the impact?
I'm sorry, I can't give you that. I suspect that it's what we've testified to on the other mandatory pregnancy bills, because as you pointed out, that's really what you've ended up doing. You're paying for the delivery, you know, the high cost items of the whole thing will have to be covered unless you've excluded this and that, you know. That throws so many options into it that I don't think anybody can judge. But I think what was testified to you before is that both OPS and Blue Cross thought it would end up being around 5% mark in increase. That's probably going to be pretty accurate with this too. But again, you can't pin your hat on that because there's so many variables in the situation. For example, under this, an all-male employee group, you aren't going to have a problem. You know, that exclusion is going to leave out, and you're never going to have to worry about ever having to cover a pregnancy, unless sex change operations get a lot better than they are anyway. There's one thing that should be pointed out to you, I think, in your deliberations, and this is where Deanne and I started our deliberations the day before yesterday, and have rather got to this because we really have worked hard to try to make sure there weren't any roadblocks that we felt we were going to have to throw into this thing. And I think that both of us can agree that we've tried to do that. We originally came with an amendment that you're not seeing because we've withdrawn it, that would have excluded the health and hospitalization coverage from this particular act. And we did this on this premise. What we've talked about all along here on both sides was that the woman had a right, if she had particular needs, to have them met just as the male employee has a right to have them made, i.e. time off, the insurance, you know, on and on and on. There has been passed by the Congress a Health Maintenance Organization Act. And here's what that Health Maintenance Organization Act means to these kinds of problems, why we submitted that thing. What it says is if you have 25 employees or more, and you offer a health insurance benefit, you must also allow them the choice of joining an HMO, provided there's one in your area. Well, in our state, it's fast approaching that all of the metropolitan, if you will, areas, the areas that have any kind of numbers in them at all, are being serviced by an HMO of some sort or another. And what that does is that if we had employees, if Representative Achilles had 30 employees, and five of those were women of childbearing age, and one of them came to him and said,
Look, we'd like to see about this HMO thing. That may meet our needs better than the policy you're giving to everybody else, because none of them care about pregnancy benefits. He would be required by this federal law to bring in the HMOs that are servicing the Salem area and saying, make a presentation to my group. And they would make that presentation, and they would say, here are our coverages and what we do. And in the case of HMOs, I know of none of them that exclude maternity benefits. And then the employee, even if it was only those three women out of the 30, could say, we opt for the HMO. Now, the cost difference, which might not exist, let's say that he pays 100%, and let's say that that's $50 a month, just for argument's sake. And let's say that the HMO turned out to be $55 a month. He could, in fact, say to that employee, great, you can have the HMO. It's going to cost you $5 a month because I only contribute $50 to these plans. So, by federal law and by the creation of this new thing, we're very quickly eliminating some of these choice problems. From an industry point of view, it's putting it exactly where we've talked to you about all mandating benefits. It puts the choice right there because he's still got 27 employees that didn't have to take a benefit they didn't care for.
Another question, Representative Cairns?
No, I'm sorry, I asked the last one.
Sorry you asked that one. Any other questions, discussion? Representative Klein? Well, that's what you already did. That was the motion that we have, the motion before us. Hmm?
Go.
I think there's only three. One, two, three. I think that's all our last three votes. I'm not sure you want that motion. I should like to get some people on record. Yeah.
No, I didn't call for the question. There's four. Maybe.
Four?
Maybe.
Almost like the last few weeks of the session. Now you've heard Representative Klein's motion. Any further discussion?
Yeah, I'd like to read the proposed amendment again to see if that does me any good at all.
Read it out loud, will you? Okay.
Section 3, the insurance commissioner shall, by rule, establish requirements for compliance with Section 2 of this 1977 Act by policies and group insurance delivered or issued for delivery in this state.
I won't go. In that case, I won't go into problems I have with that then. What the hell? Clerk, call roll.
This is the move to the floor, right?
Yep. Representative as amended.
Representatives Achilles?
No.
Faubush?
Aye.
Cairns?
Aye.
Klein?
Aye.
Morris?
No.
Shaw?
No.
Mr. Chairman?
Aye. Motion fails. I guess we're adjourned because we ran out of time, unfortunately.